Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Heidi Moore of Marketplace, in for Brian Lehrer on WNYC and WNYC.org. The fierce fighting in Syria continued this week, but it seems like the U.S. may be looking at what happens in the region after the conflict is over. While Russia and China have used their veto power to keep the U.N. from reaching a consensus on how to end that violence, this week all eyes have been on Iran's role in complicating the road to a post-Assad Syria. Joining me now is the chief Washington correspondent for The New York Times and WNYC contributor, David Sanger. Welcome back to WNYC, David.
Great to be with you, Heidi.
So the first item on the list is this hostage crisis. There's a group of 48 Iranians who were kidnapped on Saturday. The Syrian rebels say they're soldiers from the Revolutionary Guard who were sent by Iran to support the Syrian government. But Iranian officials say they were on their way to a Shiite shrine outside of Damascus, that they were just pilgrims. So regardless of who they are, Iran is holding the U.S. responsible for their fate. Connect those disparate dots for us here. Why is the U.S. responsible for those hostages?
Only responsible in the minds of the Iranians, who view the entire conflict in Syria as an extension of the shadow war between the U.S. and Israel and the West versus Iran. The Iranians think that if they lose, Syria, that they have end up losing their best friend in the Middle East, their conduit, of course, to Hamas and Hezbollah, and a key trading route, though obviously the Iranians have many other ways to trade as well. Now, I don't know the truth of why these 48 people were on the bus, but if you're going to take a religious pilgrimage, and it happens sometimes, and Damascus is certainly full of important religious sites, this seems to be an odd bit time to be doing so. I mean, putting 48 people on a bus in these conditions and putting them in the outskirts of Damascus after months of incredibly intense fighting, there's something in this story we don't understand.
Right. And there's also another unconfirmed report in this story yesterday. News filtered out that three of the hostages were killed. What's the latest on that? Do you think that's true?
Hard to know. I mean, we don't have any direct access there. Of course, the Syrians have not allowed, Syrian government has not allowed reporters to get in, so those who have gotten in have been only near the border areas. The U.S. embassy there has been closed and evacuated. Presumably, there are some intelligence officers from different countries on the ground, but not clear how well integrated they are even with these rebel groups.
Interesting. And also, Iran has been using really strong language to pursue this theory that you've said. Part of the warning from Tehran included, as the New York Times put it, unspecified consequences for the U.S. and other allies of the rebels if the Iranian hostages were harmed. That sounds like a threat. What are the tools available to Iran? And are these threats we should take seriously, especially if the Strait of Hormuz is involved and all that oil there?
Well, there's sort of three major things that the Iranians could do, Heidi. Now, one of them we're seeing already. We're seeing this sort of lash-out strikes through proxies. Consider the killings in the bomb that went off in Bulgaria. Think about the plot here late last year, if you believe the Justice Department, involving a sort of bungled effort to try to kill the Saudi ambassador to the United States in a restaurant that he and many others in Washington frequent in Georgetown.
Wow.
Many other sort of small attacks. Then there's the next level of escalation, which would be, as you suggest, trying to cut off the Strait of Hormuz, perhaps shelling some of the Saudi refineries across the Persian Gulf, which are in easy reach of Iranian missile targets. That's riskier for the Iranians because the entire U.S. Fifth Fleet is out there. They've got a very well-developed plan to try to clear the strait. If it created a crisis, it would undoubtedly shoot oil prices up very far. But the question is, how many days or weeks would it take the U.S. or others to reopen the strait? And certainly General Mattis, who controls the command that's responsible for doing this, has been intently focused on this, and you now see more American forces in the Gulf than any time I can remember in years. The third possibility is something that was being discussed very actively at a foreign policy conference that I was at for the past 5 or 6 days. And that is that if the Iranians do lose Syria, what are the chances that that then speeds their determination to build a nuclear weapon? In other words, that they would feel more isolated and that they would speed up the weapons program. And that's a significant risk.
And do you think that it would do that?
Very hard to know because it's all in the mind of one man, the supreme leader.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know what Ayatollah Khamenei has in mind. The latest intelligence reports that the U.S. Has made public have indicated that they have no evidence that there's been a political decision to go ahead with a bomb. But on the other hand, you might never make a political decision to go ahead with a bomb. The most likely strategy, and the one that I lay out in most detail in Confront and Conceal, the book I published 2 months ago now, is that the Iranians would walk right up to the edge, have all the components together, but not make the decision for final assembly unless they had to.
Right, brinkmanship. And so I'm wondering then if there's been, all we can do in the U.S., of course, is control our response. So do you think that there's been a shift in White House rhetoric around Syria this week? I want to play you a clip.
I think there has been, Heidi. It's been very subtle. But you see two significant changes underway. One is that Assad is rockier than ever. I mean, there's now fighting taking place, you know, in and around Damascus. He's beginning to lose control of parts of the capital. Aleppo has been a horror scene, but also a much harder fight for the Syrian military than they thought. And, of course, you've seen these defections, including the defection of the prime minister, who until now had been quite loyal to Assad's family. So there are all the signs of regime decay, if not regime crumbling. That then raises the question, are there any circumstances under which the United States and its allies would go in to finish the job, either with military force from the air or military forces on the ground?
Mm-hmm.
President Obama has been very reluctant to put anybody on the ground, but the fact of the matter is that since there are so many chemical weapons floating around Syria and their locations not entirely known to us, that it is entirely conceivable that they could be in a position to have to send people on the ground just to neutralize those weapons. And that's sort of what happened in Libya, though it was done pretty covertly.
Right. Well, to that point, I want to play you a clip of White House spokesman Jay Carney speaking to reporters on Tuesday about planning for a post-Assad Syria.
In this transition, we think it's essential to make sure that the state's institutions stay intact and that we send very clear expectations about avoiding sectarian warfare.
So does it seem to you like Washington is looking beyond foreign intervention and is now thinking about Assad's fall as a foregone conclusion in the near future?
I think they believe that Assad cannot hold on to power in the form that he now has it. But that doesn't mean that his sect, the Alawites, couldn't end up retreating to portions of Syria where there are particular Alawite strongholds, and that you could end up devolving into sort of a complete civil war. And remember, it's a very tribal place, and we have the same concern that we've had a year and a half ago in Libya, which is that the country could divide up in across sectarian lines, tribal lines, and that in some ways is the biggest mess. When you heard Jay Carney talk about holding together institutions, well, it sounds good, but the fact of the matter is that all institutions in Syria have been completely dependent on Assad. And it's a little bit, you might think, the interesting analog here could be what was said before the fall of Saddam Hussein in Iraq, where there was this assumption that there was a good, solid bureaucracy that would hold together. And, of course, once we got into Iraq, we discovered that the infrastructure, including the bureaucratic infrastructure, was much weaker than anybody had expected.
So in the meantime, to that point, the Syrian prime minister who defected last week is being hosted in Jordan. And that's been confirmed. And in an interview with CBS's This Morning on Tuesday, Jordan's King Abdullah weighed in on the conflict. Listen to this. Here he is with Charlie Rose.
I have a feeling that if he can't rule Greater Syria, then maybe an Alawi enclave is Plan B. And that's something that needs to be considered, because if that happens...
So that's an option, you think, for him to be part of an Alawite?
That would be, I think, for us, the worst-case scenario, because that means then the breakup of Greater Syria. And that means that everybody starts land-grabbing, which makes no sense to me. And if Syria then implodes on itself, that would create problems that would take us decades to come back from.
That was Jordan's King Abdullah. David E. Sanger of the New York Times, what do you think? It sounds like you agree. Are his fears grounded? And what would it mean if Assad broke up Syria into religious factions?
Well, this is the scenario I was mentioning just before you played the clip, which is that he could end up trying to retreat to an area where the Alawites are the strongest. And that would break up Greater Syria. And, of course, this has been a concern of King Abdullah in Jordan for some time. In fact, I talked with the king about this the end of last year when he was in Washington. And his concern, of course, is that this easily spills over into Jordan, where he's got his own problems, and he's trying to keep, by moving ahead on reforms fairly quickly, he's trying to stay ahead of the game. The question is, can he stay ahead of the game fast enough? And a breakup of Syria might make that harder to do.
And are there specific concerns then for us here in the U.S. about this? You told us off the air about the threat from al-Qaeda in Syria.
Yes, there are two big concerns. One of them is that one of the reasons the United States, the Obama administration, has been very reluctant to arm the rebels is that the rebels are not a unified group. There are many different groups together. And we saw some video released a few weeks ago that showed one rebel group with some al-Qaeda flags behind it. And we don't know if that's homegrown al-Qaeda or that's al-Qaeda coming over the border from Iraq. We don't know how significantly powerful they are. But you wouldn't want to be in a position where you armed a group and then discovered that those arms went into al-Qaeda hands. The second big issue are these chemical weapons. These are in many ways the last big stand that Assad has. He has said until now, or the government has said until now, they would reserve the use of chemical weapons stores for foreign invaders. But you could imagine that if the country did break up into different pieces, and if the weapons are stored in a dozen or two dozen places around the country, we're not going to have a firm idea who is in control of those weapons. And that could trigger either a U.S. or European or Israeli intervention inside Syria.
And Iran, as you mentioned, really is trying to take control of this. They announced, as a matter of fact, that they're going to be holding an international meeting on Syria today with representatives from 10 governments in the region. Really? Do you believe this? Who's going to go to a meeting hosted by Iran on Syria?
Yeah, I'm having a hard time believing that. I mean, let's remember what's going on here. The bigger conflict that we've all learned about in the Middle East is Shia versus Sunni. And so the biggest concern that many in the region have, led by the Saudis, is the rise of Iran and a much more powerful Shia state trying to take control over big swaths of the Middle East. So that's one reason you're not going to see a whole lot of sympathy for the Iranian position from the Arab states.
And yet the U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is holding her own meetings in Turkey on Saturday to talk about how international efforts can address the Syrian crisis. And what seems to be the U.S. role now, especially since Kofi Annan resigned from the Syria mission last week and the U.N. is hands off?
Well, you're hearing many people be quite critical, perhaps with some good reason, of the way the Obama administration has sort of held back on Syria. There was a great reliance on the United Nations because President Obama did not believe, and I think he was right in this analysis, that an intervention in Syria would look anything like the intervention in Libya a little more than a year ago. Remember, in that case, you could do it with air power. The forces that were loyal to Muammar Gaddafi, you could see in the desert, they were fairly easy to hit from the air. This is completely different. This was a battle that's taking place inside cities, very crowded. Anything from the air would result in big civilian casualties. And it looks more and more like a civil war and not something that the United States wants to get anywhere near. Set aside the fact that it's an election year, which would make it all the more complex. But it is possible that, particularly if those chemical weapons stores seem to get loose, that President Obama's hand could be forced. If it was, I suspect it would not be a lengthy intervention. It would be sort of special forces raids. But you could imagine that happening.
Right, and we're afraid of losing control, and one way that we're trying to exert that is through things like financial sanctions against Iran. And I want to ask you about that. We're going to be talking in the next segment about recent allegations of money laundering, sometimes for Iran, by foreign banks that do business here in the U.S. Why is shoring up these leaky money trails so important for U.S. policy in the region?
Well, Heidi, the main reason is that the sanctions, combined with the covert action that I and others have written about to slow the nuclear program, are the main two tools that the United States has now to avoid what many people believe is a sort of inevitable grind toward a much larger conflict with Iran. So the trick here is to make the sanctions so painful on Iran that it brings about a change in political decision-making. Whether or not that change is possible depends in large part on how well the sanctions are enforced. And so when you come up to the kind of charges that have been leveled against Standard Chartered Bank, British bank that operates, of course, in New York, that were brought up a few days ago, then it raises the question of whether or not there is evasion going on a level of hundreds of billions of dollars, which is the charge just with that bank. So I think you're going to see the bank dealt with pretty harshly in an effort to try to make an example of them. Remember, it's only been in the past few months that the sanctions have taken the next big turn, which is cutting into Iran's oil revenue, and their oil production is down quite significantly from about 2.5 million barrels a day a year ago or a year and a half ago to between 1.2 and 1.5 million barrels a day today. And that's beginning to hurt. It's hurting the middle class. Whether or not it results in changing the political decision-making, though, that's still an open question.
And so have you heard from the Obama administration in Washington about whether HSBC and Standard Chartered really did possibly launder money for Iran?
You know, so far the only things that we have seen are the regulatory filings, and they have not been terribly detailed, but the initial case as described includes, from my understanding of it, and I have not looked at the original documents, emails back and forth describing ways in which the transactions could be hidden. Now, the banks have said that this is ancient history, that these are old, that the violations were brought to the attention of the United States and the banking regulatory authorities by the banks themselves, and so forth. So it's going to take a little while to sort that out. My guess, just watching these kind of cases in the past, is that you'll see a settlement fairly quickly with a fairly large fine. So it's possible we may not see much more of the underlying evidence. The reason banks do that is that the longer the investigation goes on, the more it affects their share price, and Standard Chartered has already fallen.
And we'll learn more about that soon. We'll leave it there with you, David. Thank you. David Sanger, Chief Washington Correspondent for The New York Times and WNYC contributor. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
I'm Heidi Moore of Marketplace, in for Brian Lehrer on WNYC and WNYC.org. Coming up next, as promised, money laundering at two UK banks that do business in New York.